Welcome to this Forthright Radio for August 29th, 2018. I'm Joy LaClaire, and I'm delighted to welcome back to Forthright Radio award-winning author, journalist, David Quammen. He was our guest 5 years ago after his book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, was published. His latest book, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life, published by Simon & Schuster, came out just a couple of weeks ago. And lest you think this book being about science, the research and theorizing, and therefore it wouldn't be something you'd be interested in, let me tell you, this recent research reveals just how bacteria become resistant to our most potent antibiotics as quickly as they do, and fatally to so many. Or how horizontal gene transfer not only allowed for evolution, but may explain how certain cancers develop. And it questions our most basic concept of ourselves as a species and individuals. And this puts a new meaning on tree huggers and tree cutters. So I hope you'll stay tuned to find out more. David Quammen has won many awards for his books and magazine articles, including from the National Association of Science Writers and the Society of Biology Book Award in General Biology. His work with National Geographic is particularly noteworthy and has taken him on myriad difficult, lengthy treks, which distinguish him from most other authors. You know, things like chronicling J. Michael Fay's 2,000-mile survey hike through the forests of Central Africa, the Mega Transect. Well, rather than continue enumerating his accomplishments and accolades, I'll stop here and simply welcome him again to Forthright Radio. David Quammen, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome, Joy. It's good to be with you.
David, in books such as The Song of the Dodo and The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, you've chronicled the history of evolutionary thinking and how revolutionary they were then, and I guess in some circles they still are. Well, with The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life, you have documented the history of a more recent revolution in evolutionary thinking. Very briefly, remind us of the evolution of evolutionary theory, and particularly the origins of the concept of the tree of life. Why is it such a persistent, but now such a controversial or even discarded by some, concept?
Right. Well, the simple answer to that is the tree of life is an old idea, an old image, goes back to the Bible. But in the mid-19th century, Charles Darwin incorporated it into his thinking when he published On the Origin of Species. He said, other people have said that a great tree describes the diversity of life on Earth. He said, I believe that simile largely speaks the truth. But he made it a symbol of evolutionary change. The trunk of the tree representing the common origin of all life on Earth, the big limbs branching out representing the first diversifications and the major kingdoms of life, and then diverging. Limbs to branches to smaller branches to twigs, finally the canopy of the tree, the leaves representing the diversity of life on Earth. That's the classic evolutionary tree of life, which was accepted through the end of the 19th, most of the 20th century, and then a new revolution began in about 1977. That created eventually an understanding that the diversification of life on Earth hasn't been all about diverging, species lineages splitting and changing and moving away from one another, but there has also been convergence. There has been a phenomenon called horizontal gene transfer, which means genes moving sideways from one limb of life to another, from one branch to another, from one species of creature to another, even from one kingdom of life to another, genes moving sideways, horizontally, and not just vertically from parents to offspring. And so that's what I've written about in this book, The Tangled Tree. We've realized that the picture of evolutionary history on Earth is tangled, and it's not as neatly tree-like as Darwin and everyone else until the late 20th century had imagined.
And as I said in the introduction, this is not just dry science, although it is that as well. This has some very important real-life ramifications for us as a species, and as I also said, it challenges the very idea of a species and challenges the idea of individuals, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
As you so often do, David Quammen, you tell the story using the lives of individual scientists. And if we could say that there was a main character in your book, it would be Carl Woese. What was his role in this revolution in evolutionary thinking?
Right. Well, I'm a firm believer that when you write about science, you've got to do more than explain. You need to tell stories. People want to read about people. So when you write about science, you write about the people who do science, real human beings, men and women. And there are a lot of stories of people in this book, of the people who made the various discoveries. But as you say, Joy, at the center of the book is this character, Carl Woese, this little-known microbiologist working at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois. He was the one who, in the 1970s, he had a deep passion for understanding the early history of life on Earth and the big, profound changes that have occurred in the history of evolution. So he decided he was going to explore those questions with primitive gene sequencing tools, primitive sequencing of DNA and RNA, the information molecules at the core of all living creatures. And he did this using, you know, fancy gene sequencing was not available at that time. That arose in the 1990s. In the early 21st century. So he used a method that he had concocted involving toxic chemicals and high voltage and explosive solvents and radioactive phosphorus, all in his little lab there in Urbana, Illinois, with some courageous grad students and assistants and postdoctoral fellows. And he began looking at, I call it a Rosetta Stone molecule, a particular molecule. It's an RNA, not a DNA molecule. RNA is the single-stranded information molecule as opposed to the famous double-strand, double-helix of DNA. He started looking at this molecule, which exists in all living creatures, sequencing portions of that molecule, and then comparing these sequences, the letters of the molecule, the ACTG of DNA, the ACGU of RNA. Those are the alphabet of genetics. And he started comparing different creatures with one another using these catalogs of letters, of code, and he found some amazing things. The first thing he found was an entirely new form of life, a kingdom of life that had been unknown to exist on Earth and eventually became known as the Archaea. Archaea as in archaeology, suggesting old, because people thought that these were the oldest form of life on Earth. And for that discovery, Carl Woese made the front page of the New York Times above the fold on November 3rd, 1977. This little guy with white hair sitting at his desk with his feet up on his desk in his Adidas. And that's, as I say in the beginning of this book, that's sort of a core moment around which this whole story revolves.
Yes, and Carl Woese is quite a character. He's not all that pleasant to, well, some of his grad students adore him and found him wonderful. But many people found him really cranky and cantankerous and not easy to work with.
That's right. Absolutely. He was a crotchety fellow. He was not a good teacher of undergraduates. He was not a good lecturer. He was not good at presenting his ideas in public except through writing. But he was this brilliant, profound thinker, innovator, a revolutionary. And some people thought he was distant and pompous and committed only to his science. But then there were other people, and I found some of them, who got through his shell. Students and friends that he made around the university who knew him as a guy who would love to go out on a Friday afternoon and drink beer or drink homemade champagne and then maybe get a little bit too liquored up and go sit and watch a Cheech and Chong movie, beery barbecues in his backyard. There was one big fellow that I found, a big bear-like man named Charlie Vosbrink. I just sort of stumbled across him. He had been a good friend of Woese, and he told me stories of how when Woese got too pompous, Charlie would pick him up and throw him in the bushes, and they'd just all be laughing and having a fine old time. This is the man who as I say in the book, was the most important biologist of the 20th century that you've never heard of.
And he really wanted to figure out how it went from primordial soup to life.
That's right.
That's a very big question.
That's right. We know from fossil evidence and biochemical evidence that Earth supported life beginning around 3.5 to 3.8 billion years ago. Billion. Almost 4 billion years. And Carl Woese was interested in the whole stretch of that time, in earliest cellular life, 3.5 or 3.8 billion years ago, in what came before the existence of the first cellular creatures. There had to be earlier forms of something roughly lifelike, and then the divergence of cellular forms into what we thought of as the two great kingdoms of life until he came along. And that was the bacteria and everything else, all of us more complicated creatures, animals, plants, fungi, things that have cells with cell nuclei. And he discovered this third great limb of life, the archaea. He wanted to know how all of that happened and how that affected the course of evolutionary history ever since.
One of my favorite characters in your book is Lynn Margulis. What an interesting woman she was. And listeners may be interested, now this is not the most feminist thing I'm going to say this broadcast, but she actually had been married to Carl Sagan before she became Lynn Margulis. Am I right about that?
That's right, yes. As an 18-year-old undergraduate at the University of Chicago, she met this brilliant, very sort of vain, eloquent fellow undergraduate named Carl Sagan. Her name was Lynn Alexander. She married him. That was her first husband. She was married again to a fellow named Nick Margulis. She had four children, I think it is. And Lynn, who I knew a little bit near the end of her life, wrote a lot about, not just about her science, but about her struggle as a woman to do science in an environment where science was not all that hospitable to women, particularly to women who had children, young children. She said at one point, wrote in a book, that she discovered how difficult it is to be both a serious scientist, a wife, and a mother. And as a result of those difficulties, she said, I quit my job as a wife twice because I was much more interested in those other two jobs, being a leading scientist, a fine scientist, and being a good mother. She was an interesting, forceful, original, and very charming person who made some of the most important contributions to this revolution that I describe in the book of understanding that the history of life has been tangled and not merely a classical tree-shaped story.
Did she create the concept of endosymbiosis that led to our understanding of how crucial parts of our cells, the mitochondria and the chloroplasts and centrioles. She
right.
was crucial in coming up with that as a concept, was she not?
Well, she was crucial in reviving that as a concept. Those concepts dated back to late 19th, early 20th century. As you said, this theory under her care became known as endosymbiosis. And what that means is the understanding of the origins of complex cells. I mentioned complex cells with cell nuclei. And you mentioned a couple of the other important internal organs in these complex cells, mitochondria, which are these little organs that are involved in energy packaging in complex cells, and chloroplasts in plant cells, which do the photosynthesizing, use sunlight to create the food for plant cells. Now, this theory of endosymbiosis suggested, even before Lynn Margulis, other scientists had suggested the idea that mitochondria in our complex cells are actually captured bacteria back somewhere at the origins of complex cells. A single simple cell swallowed or was infected by a single bacterial particle, and that bacteria, instead of being digested or being expelled, stayed, replicated inside that cell, and eventually reached a symbiotic relationship with the host cell within which it existed, and turned into, over untold generations, turned into these bodies, these organs in our cells called mitochondria. So this theory suggested that we contain bacteria inside all of our cells that have been turned into functional organs within our cells. Likewise, plants and the chloroplasts. Chloroplasts are captured bacteria, according to this theory. Now, Lynn Margulis revived this theory in 1967 when she was a young microbiologist. She was using microscopy, using microscopic evidence, visual evidence, and revives this theory and said, I think these things are captured bacteria. People thought she was crazy. They thought she was wacky. They dismissed her as a fringe, as a crank. And then after Carl Woese and the beginning of genome sequencing, other scientists looked at these bodies inside of our cells, these mitochondria and chloroplast in plant cells, recognized that they contain DNA also, that their DNA is different from the cell's nuclear DNA, sequenced that DNA, and found, lo and behold, Lynn Margulis was right. These things have genomes that are much more similar, close matches to certain bacteria that we know of still living on planet Earth. So that confirmed, that genomic evidence confirmed her microscope evidence that these bodies inside of our cells are captured bacteria. So we humans and all animals, all plants, are in fact mosaics of other creatures. We're composites of other creatures. And then you get into that idea, as you mentioned, of the challenge to the very notion of an individual.
That also brings up the concept of infective heredity, that much of the ancient and even ongoing, I mean, this is not a process that stopped 3.5 billion years ago. This is right. happening today. Let's talk about infective heredity.
Right. Well, that is a phrase that was coined by a great microbiologist in the 1950s, Joshua Lederberg, Nobel Prize winner. He was studying bacteria and the genetics of bacteria, and he spotted this phenomenon of bacteria being capable of passing genes, DNA, back and forth across, not just across boundaries between individuals, like one thing he called it was bacterial sex, another metaphor for passing genes back and forth, but that this could happen between bacteria that were unrelated to one another, different species of bacteria, different families of bacteria, passing genes back and forth. And so he coined the phrase infective heredity because these genes passed back and forth, then became part of the hereditary genome of the bacteria that received them. And this was also applicable to things that viruses were doing. Now, this I'll jump us forward and describe the fact that we now know, because of high-powered and very effective and fast genome sequencing, we know the entire human genome, we know the entire genomes of lots of other creatures, and scientists now recognize that 8% of the human genome consists of viral DNA that has come in sideways into our lineage by infection rather than having come down directly by parent-to-offspring inheritance throughout the entire lineage of animals. 8% of us, 8% of our genomes is captured viral DNA that has gotten into our genomes by infection. And this involves retroviruses, which patch their own DNA into the cells that they infect. If a retrovirus like HIV does that, it patches its genome into our immune cells and eventually causes the disease AIDS. But if a retrovirus, if it infects and patches its genome into reproductive cells, germ cells, sperm cells, egg cells, ovary cells, testes cells, then that viral DNA entering the genome of those cells becomes heritable, is passed down to sons and daughters. And that's what has happened to the point of accumulating 8% of our genome, which is viral DNA. And some of that is DNA that's crucial to the functioning of human bodies even today, viral DNA in our genomes.
Well, let's go there, because one of the things I found most fascinating, and I'm going to say that a lot because I found a lot of things fascinating in your book,
well,
David Common. But anyway, the role of the retroviruses in creating the entire family of mammals because of its role in placental tissue. Talk about
that's
that,
right.
Both in evolution and also to all of us now.
That's right, yes. There is a scientist, I'll start with him, there's a scientist named Thierry Heidemann who works at an institute on the south edge of Paris. I started reading about his work as I was coming toward the end of this book, And he and his group in Paris have discovered a gene, it's one of a group of genes, that is a viral gene. It's one of these captured viruses that has inserted itself into the human genome. The gene is called syncytin 2, S-Y-N, not syncytin like my hometown Cincinnati, but S-Y-N-C-Y-T-I-N. Syncytin 2 is a gene in the human genome that creates a protein necessary for the membrane between the placenta and the fetus in human pregnancy. This viral gene was originally a gene that created an envelope around the viral particle. It's called the envelope gene, a membrane around the viral particle. But it got into the human genome through infection. It was repurposed, it was adapted, it evolved a bit, changed a little bit, and turned into a gene that in humans creates a different sort of membrane, the membrane between the placenta and the fetus, a membrane that's completely necessary for transporting nutrients from the placenta into the fetus inside a pregnant woman and transporting waste products from the fetus back out to the mother so that she can void those waste products, completely necessary to the successful development of pregnancy. And yet it's a membrane formed by a viral gene. Now, there are different, as you mentioned, there are different versions of this gene that go all the way back through the mammal lineage, different retroviruses that have infected the animal lineage and eventually led to the creation of this membrane that made pregnancy, internal pregnancy, possible. Placental mammals could not exist without the successive different versions of this gene that have been captured. So somewhere, 100 million years ago or more, a primitive pre-mammal, probably an egg-laying creature, was infected by a virus, and this gene was internalized, and it eventually developed and changed and adapted to make possible the beginnings of mammalian life, internal pregnancy, rather than egg-laying.
And there was one other feature that was really important to this, and that was, as you had mentioned before, the immunosuppression aspect
right.
of it. Because think about it, we don't want the mother rejecting the fetus. So very
right.
briefly talk about that.
That's right. Well, with sexual reproduction, in mammals, the fetus shares only 50% of its DNA with the mother. The father's DNA is there too. So if the mother's immune system were not in some way alerted or dampened, there would be an inclination to reject the fetus because it would be perceived as an alien life form. And so this wonderful researcher in Paris, Thierry Heidemann, has published work with his group suggesting that the original capture of the virus and the original adaptation of this envelope gene resulted in some protection of an internally held fetus from the mother's immune system, that the first function, perhaps, of this kind of gene was to protect the fetus from the immune system of the mother. And then it also evolved this ability to transport nutrients in and waste products out. As Thierry Heidemann said to me, this is a hypothesis, the part about the immune function of this having been the original reason why this piece of DNA was retained and adapted in the mammal lineage. It's a hypothesis, but it's a very persuasive and very interesting hypothesis. First, an immune protection for an internally held offspring rather than one that was going to be, you know, laid out of the female in the form of an egg. First, the immune protection, and then it was adapted also for the transport of nutrients in and waste products out, something that you can't do with an egg. When a fetus is contained in a calcium egg, and even if it's inside the mother, that the transport of nutrients stop. That's what the yolk is for. That's the package of nutrients. So this was a whole new way of producing offspring, holding them internally, and then nurturing them with the transfer of nutrients and waste products, and then eventually giving birth, made possible by horizontal gene transfer, viral infection.
We're speaking with David Quammen on Forthright Radio. His latest book is The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. So the infective heredity and horizontal gene transfer can be very, very scary sounding. But here is an example of we wouldn't be here without it. But let's get into some of the scary stuff, the antibiotic resistance problem.
Yeah. Yes. This is another example of the medical implications for human beings of this bizarre phenomenon, horizontal gene transfer. It is now realized that the problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, these killer bugs that can't be stopped with modern antibiotics, the reason that has spread around the world so quickly is because of this phenomenon, horizontal gene transfer. Now, the old-fashioned classic Darwinian view of how a bacterium would become resistant to antibiotics is sort of similar to the way, for instance, insects might become resistant to a particular pesticide. There is incremental mutation as creatures reproduce themselves, as they copy their DNA. There are tiny changes in that code that I alluded to, that alphabet of letters. Mistakes are made one by one, and that produces some variation within populations. Natural selection works on that, and then either the insects, individuals that are most resistant to pesticides, or the bacteria that are most resistant to a particular antibiotic, those are the ones that survive, the survival of the fittest. Gradual evolution so that a bacterial strain can eventually become resistant to a particular kind of antibiotic, penicillin or streptomycin or erythromycin. And that's a good story, and that's a true story. Incremental development, evolution of resistance. But scientists have realized that once that resistance evolves the slow way within one strain of bacteria, it can be transferred instantly to another strain of bacteria, a completely different species of bacteria, a different family of bacteria, by horizontal gene transfer, by movement of those genes sideways from one bacterium into another, in the form of little packages of genes called plasmids that move sideways between bacteria. And the recognition of this began in 1963 with the work of a Japanese researcher named Tsutomu Watanabe, Dr. Watanabe. He published this with some colleagues in 1963. People are still unaware of it, but it's now understood by those who study this that horizontal gene transfer is moving whole packages of genes, conferring resistance at once to four or five different kinds of important antibiotics, moving them from one kind of bacterium to another. For instance, from Salmonella into E. coli, from E. coli into Staphylococcus, from Staphylococcus into Streptococcus. And that's the reason the problem of antibiotic resistance, which now kills, I think it's more than 11,000 people a year in the U.S. and many more thousands around the world, that's the reason this problem has swept around the world so quickly.
Talk about how quickly they develop the ability to resist them. And also, is it because bacteria do not have nuclei that they particularly can do this adaptation so quickly, do you think?
Yes. The answer to your second question is yes. The fact that bacteria are simpler cells, they do not carry their genomes, their DNA, sealed inside a nucleus. They carry it as a single strand floating around in the liquid of the cell. And then they also carry these additional bits of genome that I mentioned, these little rings of DNA, these little bracelets called plasmids. And those in particular can be transferred from one bacterium into another in a sort of a smooching or almost like a mating operation. A little thread, a little tube is formed between the two bacterial particles, and a plasmid goes charging across from one to the other, almost like, you know, fertilization or mating, except that, and sometimes this is called bacterial sex, but it's not really sex because it involves the transfer of DNA, but it does not involve reproduction. The reproduction of bacteria occurs by splitting, and it's a completely separate process from this process of horizontal gene transfer. So yes, this happens much more readily among bacteria and also among that other group of simple-celled creatures that Carl Woese discovered, the archaea, but it's now known that it does also happen in complex cells, in cells like our own that carry their DNA inside nuclei. It can still happen, for instance, by way of retroviruses, and horizontal gene transfer of DNA by retroviruses is sort of a drag-and-drop phenomenon. A virus can pick up a piece of DNA from one creature that it has infected, and then as that virus replicates, it replicates that new piece of DNA borrowed from some other creature, and then when other descendants of that viral strain infect some other creature, completely different species, it can carry that foreign DNA in and drop that in the cells of the new creature, horizontal gene transfer. And this, of course, was completely beyond imagining for Charles Darwin. Genetics was beyond imagining for him. He did not have a theory of heredity, or he didn't have a correct theory of heredity. And even during most of the 20th century, this process of movement of DNA between species, sideways, between kingdoms of life, was unrecognized until Carl Woese started sequencing his Rosetta Stone molecule. And then other scientists were influenced by him. Genome sequencing became fast and easy in the late 20th century. And lo and behold, scientists realized that there's lots of craziness that has gone on with genes moving sideways from one limb to another in the tree of life.
I just want to say one more thing about those plasmids you were talking about and the antibiotic resistance. It's thought that one of the mechanisms is that it allows the bacteria that we're using the antibiotics on, it allows them, for example, to pump tetracycline out of the bacteria. So we're putting it in, but this resistance transfer factor allows it to literally pump it back out of the bacteria. They're little guys, but they're pretty clever.
They are. Evolution is amazing. It creates these systems, and yes, that's one of them. That's one of the mechanisms for antibiotic resistance. I think the scientist that I interviewed about this, Stuart Levy, named it an efflux mechanism, essentially a pumping out of this material that would be poison for a bacterium if it were allowed to stay in there, and the bacterium has just evolved a way of pumping it right back out.
And I believe you said in your book that the species of bacteria that we're trying to eliminate in the human body or an animal or something, they can develop this effective resistance within basically 10 years, right?
Well, they can evolve, yes, they can evolve resistance. An individual strain of bacterium can evolve resistance, I'm sure, over a course of 10 years. This is a particular problem in hospitals because lots of people there are being treated with antibiotics, and it's a great environment for Darwinian evolution, the old-fashioned incremental form. You've got a strain of bacteria, and people are infected with it, and they're being treated with antibiotics, so you've got a real concentrated survival of the fittest natural selection situation. So it's thought that many of these superbugs resistant to antibiotics develop in hospital situations. But then once it has developed, you even say it takes 10 years for Staphylococcus to develop resistance to a new antibiotic. Once the Staphylococcus has developed that resistance, what makes it really problematic and scary is that Staphylococcus can pass that gene for that resistance into Streptococcus or into E. coli, anywhere where the two of them are sharing an environment. For instance, in the belly or the throat of a person, horizontal gene transfer can occur right there. And then when particles of that bacteria that has acquired it come out of that person, then those bacteria are also resistant and can cause a killer infection in someone else.
Okay, I think we've terrified our listeners enough for now.
I love talking about these technical things, and I'm so grateful, Joy, to the fact that you've said this is a book about people too. It's a book about mystery stories and the humans who solve scientific mystery stories, characters like Lynn Margulis and Carl Woese and Ford Doolittle and Tsutomu Watanabe. So I don't want to scare anybody. This is a book that's meant to be enjoyed and to be a page-turner as well as to be illuminating about this amazing revolution in the understanding of life's history.
Okay, well, let's get to maybe the primary mystery of what is the current thinking of how we got from primordial soup to the first pre-cell and then celled organisms.
Yes, okay. Well, that's deep in that nearly 4 billion year history of life on Earth. And we don't really know the answers. There's a lot of argument that surrounds the origins of life and the early life subject. But one of the things that Carl Woese seized upon was the fact that that molecule that I mentioned, RNA, the single-stranded genetic molecule, is possibly the earliest form of lifelike processes. This is an idea that Woese embraced and was given a name by another scientist, Walter Gilbert, and that was the RNA world. So there is this image in the writings of Carl Woese and the writings of Wally Gilbert of the RNA world, which is a world in which molecules, almost 4 billion years ago, acquired the ability to replicate themselves using materials, building blocks from a liquid environment to form longer molecules that were capable of competing against one another for these building blocks. And the suspicion, the hypothesis, is that those earliest self-replicating long complex molecules were molecules of RNA, seizing building blocks from the environment and putting them together into these long molecular structures competing against one another, and that the more successful, the more adept, the more fit of those molecules survived while others did not. And that this process eventually led to some other, revolutionary moments, such as the creation of a cell wall. But before cellular creatures, before bacteria, before archaea, the suspicion is there was the RNA world.
And I remember as a teenager reading about the world back then. It was not an oxygen atmosphere, and I was thrilled when I learned that it was these early creatures that metabolized the soup back then, and they off-gassed the oxygen that created our atmosphere, and I'm still thrilled by that.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great part of the story. It's something that Lynn Margulis seized upon and wrote about, too. The fact that one of the great transitions in life on Earth was the creation of an oxygen-rich atmosphere. And that oxygen-rich atmosphere itself was created by, I think it was mostly photosynthesizing microbial forms, algae and other primitive creatures that could take carbon dioxide and could take other molecules in the environment, in the oxygen-poor environments where they lived, principally the oceans, and could produce oxygen. And then the production of an oxygen-rich environment was crucial for the emergence of more complex creatures that metabolize oxygen and release carbon dioxide as a byproduct, and eventually allowing, among other things, allowing creatures to become multicellular, larger, more complex, and come walking out on land.
Let's talk about some of the descendants of those early creatures and this third kingdom. And we won't go into whether it's three kingdoms or five kingdoms or domains. We'll let the listeners read your book for that. But talk about some of these very strange archaea and the environments in which they are able to thrive.
Right. Well, these, again, are the creatures that Carl Woese discovered in 1977. They had been around, they had been noticed, but they were taken for bacteria. They were thought to be regular bacteria, except they had these peculiar habits. For instance, some of them lived in oxygen-poor environments, and they burned carbon dioxide, and they produced methane, a particular kind of gas. We know it as a greenhouse gas now. So these were called the methanogens, meaning they generated methane. And people thought, oh, this is just a peculiar kind of bacteria. It was the first group that Carl Woese worked on with his new gene sequencing technique. And he collaborated with another microbiologist at the University of Illinois, a wonderful man named Ralph Wolf, who was an expert on these methane-producing, supposedly, bacteria. And Woese looked at the genomes of these things using his method of sequencing them. And he walked into the office of Ralph Wolf and he said, "Wolf, these things aren't even bacteria," meaning they were a completely new form of life. Now, so that was one of the first groups he worked on, but then he discovered that there were some other groups of supposedly bacteria that also had peculiar life histories, peculiar habits, lived in strange, extreme environments, that also were part of this group, the archaea. For instance, microbes from hot springs in Yellowstone Park that lived at high temperatures. Other microbes that lived in very acidic environments. Other microbes that lived in very salty environments. So they liked extreme environments. There's a term for that. They call them extremophiles, extremism-loving creatures. Not all archaea are these extremophiles. Some of them live in milder circumstances, the way bacteria do. But many of them, including the ones that Ralph Wolf and Carl Woese first looked at, were these extremophiles, these creatures that lived in these strange, extreme environments. Carl Woese even made a field trip with one of his younger colleagues, I think it was probably in the 1980s, out here, out to Yellowstone, to collect microbes from some of these hot springs in Yellowstone Park. Carl Woese, you know, he was not an outdoorsy guy, but he was there with these other adventurous young microbiologists scooping up slime from some of the hot springs in Yellowstone, taking it back to the laboratory to sequence the genomes. And he told his friend Norman Pace, who led this expedition, that, well, that was great. I loved that. I loved that adventure with you. But six months later, my back still hurts from sleeping on the ground in Yellowstone.
You inject humor into your books often, David Quammen. And I particularly enjoyed your section heading, E Pluribus Human. And let's spend the remaining time talking about how our concepts of species, and even our concept of individual, has kind of been shaken up by these recent developments. Talk about right. that, please.
I mentioned in that section at the end of the book that there are three categorical ideas, three absolute ideas that have been embraced by science and also popular thinking throughout the 100, 150 years after Darwin published his great book, Origin of Species. And those three categorical ideas are, first of all, the idea of a species as a unitary concept, a unitary entity. One species is discrete from other species. The second was the idea of an individual. An individual is a discrete, unitary thing. There is an individual named Charles Robert Darwin, or at least there was. There is a dog named Mittens. Those are individuals. And the third categorical is the idea of the tree of life. The history of life has been shaped like a tree, with the branches and the limbs always diverging, never converging. And now, as I say in this final section of the book, those three categoricals, the categorical of the discrete species, the discrete individual, and the tree of life, we now know those are all wrong. Those are simplifications that have obscured the real story, which is much more complicated. A species is not completely discrete from all other species because horizontal gene transfer can move genes sideways, not just between closely related species, where the term for it is hybridizing, but between species that aren't closely related. There's even one scientist whose work and ideas I describe in the book who says that all bacteria on Earth of all different kinds essentially are one species, one great superorganism capable of moving genes sideways in every direction from every individual bacterial particle to any other. And the idea of the individual now is challenged because we know that Len Margulis's theory of endosymbiosis has been confirmed. We know that we as, quote, individual humans, our bodies contain captured bacteria and captured viruses that are essential to our functioning as living individuals. So we're not pure categorical individuals. We are mosaics of other creatures. And finally, the tree of life. It is not exactly shaped like a tree. It's a tangled tree. It's something that has channels moving sideways from major limb to major limb. It has horizontal gene transfer. It has endosymbiosis. So that instead of the history of life being shaped like the classic Darwinian tree, we now have this thing, this web-like, network-like, partly tree-like thing for which there really is no neat visual metaphor. And that's why my book has ended up titled The Tangled Tree.
Yes, and in addition to those examples, you also give the examples of social insects, ants and bees and things like that. They really can't be although there is an individual bee that flies around, by herself, she wouldn't survive. It's the colony that is the
right.
organism.
Social insects, ants, termites, bees. Scientists have made the point that really when you're talking about, say, a colony of ants with one queen and a number of asexual workers and soldiers, it is the colony that is the individual and not the worker ant or the soldier ant. And likewise, people are familiar with the creature that we call a Portuguese man of war. It's a sort of a swim bladder thing that floats in the ocean with these tentacles dangling down, and it's related to the jellyfish, and we think of it as an individual, just as you think of a jellyfish as an individual animal. But in fact, a Portuguese man of war is a colony of individuals, individual cells that aggregate together, that practice division of labor, different individuals of this group. It's one species. They glom together and form a Portuguese man of war. So just as the Portuguese man of war, we realize that it is not an individual. It is a colony. It is an aggregate. It is a mosaic. Now, in a deeper sense, because of this revolution in genomic evolutionary biology, we realize that we animals, we humans too, are in a very important and real sense aggregates, mosaics of other creatures.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, David Quammen. Thank you so much for joining us again on Forthright Radio. And your latest book, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life, is just a delight to read. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Joy. Thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Likewise. Our guest today has been David Quammen. His latest book, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month and every other fifth Wednesday. From the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LeClaire. And you can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.